known I was in agony.
Have you spoken?
She calls, to make me crazy, every other night. Sonny was being responsible, not abandoning the cripple, making me vow that I'd see her before I left. They were brief, thwarted conversations in which I pivoted between rage and terrible longing.
There is surely nothing like young love, said June dolefully.
I spent an instant trying to imagine the Edgars at this stage as young lovers, still on the threshold with each other. What he saw in her seemed clear to me, one of those bold girls, a rebel beneath the veneer of genteel manners. He was wedding courage. A man could never have too much of that on his own. But why did she choose him? Edgar was going to be a preacher then, and she a preacher's wife. She had to know she wasn't one for the country club, the cotillions, or the teas. Why him? Why Edgar? His commitments, I thought, they must have shone with the power of the sun. She must have had some tussle with herself. She must have thought she was going to purify herself in the fiery forge of Edgar's faith. Idle guesses, but they came to me with the metal of conviction. She had finally settled again at the small table beside her teacup and lit another cigarette. I still don't understand what gives with the cops, I said. How could they blame Edgar? After last night? I told her about what had happened on Campus Bull. More than 100 people had gathered before the Damon cops had moved everyone along. People are really pissed now, really pissed. It could have been anybody, right?
Right.
June said dully. Her eye did not meet mine. Instead, she looked through a ring of smoke.
Look, it's all ridiculous. They know he's covered. They don't care. They'd know he'd have to be covered. Let them assume what they like, whatever they like. After all of this, could he possibly be that careless? He was with his lawyers until almost 3 last night. The same men who are going to bail him out can alibi him, but they don't care.
She touched the shawl to her eyes.
They're probably going to come back for me soon. I should count myself lucky they didn't take me now. Will you look after Niall?
Of course, but that's not going to happen. I tried to comfort her, but she was convinced she was in peril, that Edgar and she were now the targets of unreasoning oppression. Were you with the lawyers, too? I asked her.
Most of the time. I left about midnight.
The bomb, she had said, was at 1. Her eyes lit on mine and then deflected a bit. And? I asked.
What?
Can you account for yourself? I sounded stiff enough to be my father.
If it comes to that,
she answered, and then canted her head vaguely across the kitchen, indicating the wall that adjoined Michael's place. She closed her eyes momentarily, smote by some new pain that crimped her mouth.
You might as well know, she said. He was quite upset. Quite. He didn't take this news very well. He's appalled. Completely appalled. His life is in those labs. He could have been there. He knows this man.
She dropped her head into her hands. When she lifted her face, worn by worry, she looked right at me.
He thinks he was betrayed, she said.
On the way to work, I joined the little dribble of gawkers who had already come up the road to the ARC. The iron gates were drawn closed, and you could see that the police were out and ready to cordon off the road farther down toward campus. I was astonished that at 6 a.m., in the weak light of sunrise, I was not the sole spectator. Cars were parked along the gravel road, and we all stood, 20 or 30 of us, with our hands to the bars, as if we were at the zoo. The others seemed to be people who had driven down from the city and the bedroom burbs of Alameda to see what a bomb really does. What it did in this case was to gouge up a substantial crater in which the scattered rubble of the building was heaped, bricks, glass, plaster, pieces of pipe, the odd, randomly intact remnants of walls and floor tile. Hours later, there was still an impression of dust in the air. An entire projecting wing of the building was gone. It looked like the remains after the wrecking ball. A latticework of iron supports between the walls and floors was revealed at points, while a lone beam, corkscrewed by the force, protruded from the portion of the building that was standing, along with twisted piping and a single strand of black wire balled up like a kink of hair where the walls were torn away. The fractioned remains of the third floor, risers, subfloor, three blown-out windows, and a piece of a lab table, hung midair at a 40-degree angle. And the roof was torn off, even where the walls looked sound, so that the building reminded you of a bald-headed man. Out on the lawn of the facility, a yellow tape barrier had been stretched. Beside me, a portly, gray-haired man with a plaid shirt and plastic pocket protector pointed out to his wife a chunk of brick resting on the lawn, which needed to be mowed. I was late for work, but unconcerned. My final day would be tomorrow. I'd taken my transistor, and on the hour, I stopped wherever I was along my delivery route to listen to news. Nixon's speech had brought a turbulent reaction on campuses across the country. At Ohio State University, 100 students had been arrested, 3 wounded, and 70 more injured in an angry confrontation with National Guardsmen who had shot at them with rubber bullets to break up an anti-war demonstration. 20,000 people were expected in New Haven to rally in support of Bobby Seale, the co-chairman of the Black Panther Party, who was on trial there along with 20 other Panthers, charged with conspiring to murder a snitch named Alex Rackley. But the accounts of the ARC bombing dominated the local news. The injured physicist was in surgery at the Damon Medical Center, and the radio report said more than 10 people had been taken in for questioning. Listening to the accounts, I felt vaguely vindicated, almost cheerful. The world was being made to pay for its madness. I was in the city, in Noe Valley, filling a coin box on 18th Street, when I heard a report that shrunk my innards in panic. FBI, ATF, and police experts sifting the debris at the ARC had come up with a number of items that they believed had been used to prepare the device. Included were the scorched remains of a single can of battery acid. I had no idea what to do about Hobie. We had not spoken in weeks. I told myself again and again that he wasn't involved, that it was a stupid coincidence, but of course I could not accept that. On my way home, near 3, I stopped at Graham's. I'd brought along the last of Sonny's boxes. I had been determined simply to leave them by the door, but now she was the only person I could think of to give me cool counsel about Hobie. I rang the bell a number of times. The sky was clear, the day thin and cool, and various bright blossoms struggled toward the sunshine in the large garden that fronted Graham's coach house. "Sahib!" Graham opened the door and rubbed his eyes. He had been sleeping. He was in his American briefs.
"You wish?"
"I'd like a word with Sonny."
"Klonsky? Haven't seen her all week, mate. More. The gypsy moth, that one. Here and there. Waiting tables down at Robson's. 2 shifts. Trying to raise a treasury for her departure. Peace Corps thing seems ready to commence. Going to the Philippines, she is."
She'd shared the news with me during her last call.
"Colorful locale, I suppose," said Graham. "Whole gambit's a bit unclear to me, I must say. In a dither, really. Beneath the cool exterior, my estimate at least."
As much as I hated him, it was consoling to hear a judgment so close to mine. Over time, I'd begun to take Graham's measure. He played a sort of showboat Brit, more English than the Queen. He made few accommodations to the American vocabulary and uttered Anglicisms whenever he could, as if he remained convinced that the War of Independence had not been decided on cultural merit. At moments, his voice trilled in his Oxford accent. At other times, he sounded like a Cockney chimney sweep. He had more shapes than Caliban, a man for all moments, who placed himself above American culture, and who, I see now, would have run for hiding if anyone mentioned returning to his homeland. He savored American freedom and the transposition he'd made to a realm where no one thought less of his middle-class accent.
"Step in, Kimosabe. Neighbor types get their knickers in a knot when I go traipsing about in my johnnies."
He offered me coffee or tiger's milk, but I went no farther than the foyer to drop Sonny's things. Without the exotic party scene, the house was appealing, small but lovely, with marks of money and intellect that reminded me of University Park. Simple sofas and large paintings on the walls bristling with emotion, many Mexican artifacts, and rugs thrown down at angles. The tasteful furnishings struck a false note against the sybaritic life Graham led here. I expected the odor of fucking to linger like traces from a litter box. He mentioned the bombing, naturally. University people today were speaking of little else. On campus Bull in the morning, a trio of hippies, lit up on crystal meth, were rambling up and down the walks, crooning that the rev had begun.
"I heard they, like, found a can of battery acid at the scene. Any idea, man, what that's about?"
"Battery acid," repeated Graham. He hadn't heard that. "Not too surprising, I'd say. Chemical name, sulfuric acid, one of your principal ingredients in nitroglycerin, which every anarchist in Revo knows can be mixed with paraffin, gun cotton, a few other items to make plastique."
He nodded, satisfied as always with his vast learning.
"What about sandbags?" I asked. "They wouldn't have anything to do with this, right?"
"Oh, contraire, laddie. When you've got your high-powered explosive ready to go, you direct it by tamping. Create an aperture for the explosive force. Sandbags the best, apparently. Well-placed sandbag very important to effective bombing, so they say."
Graham scratched his nose. I could not move now. "Hobie," I thought. "Oh, Jesus. Hobie." Graham was watching me carefully.
"Any little bugger we hold near and dear involved with this battery acid and sandbags?"
he asked. Graham's revolution was made in the bedroom, where the persons present could become a universe without rules, where their conduct could be as uniquely personal as it is within a dream. Otherwise, he preferred peace. As he'd made clear since I met him, he didn't approve of the Edgars.
"It was just a story I heard, Graham."
"That's so, love. Plenty of stories about. Bloody place is fucking rife with rumor, I'd say. Mythopoesy at work. Psychedelic era, what? Hard to tell fantasy from reality all round. Wouldn't give you tuppence for most of what people say."
He eyed me coolly, contemptuously.
"Jolly good moment to step forward, I'd think. Sell out or watch out, that'd be my advice. Sides have been chosen, love. Best recognize that."
I wasn't sure if he was trying to wring information from me or do me a favor. He passed me a penetrating look, clearly meant in warning, and then nodded his whitish page boy toward the door. He said he'd tell Sonny I'd come by. By the time I got home from work near 4, Edgar had been released. As it turned out, the Damon Town police had rounded up the usual suspects, every rad they could find from 100 Flowers. Kellett, Edgar, Cleveland Marsh. 6 or 7 others. Members of Edgar's organization had stood vigil outside the police station most of the day, shouting slogans. I felt some momentary guilt that I had not joined them. Around 2, Edgar's lawyer had filed a petition in court. And the police, rather than undergo the hearing, had released him and most of the others. They told Edgar and the reporters that he remained a suspect. The only one who was still in custody was Cleveland. When they'd picked him up, they'd found 4 pounds of cocaine and more than 1,000 cellophane-wrapped hits of LSD in his apartment. He would be charged with felonies. As Edgar told me about all of this, I had another anxious thought of Hobie, I knew better than to ask Edgar about Hobie's role, since revolutionary discipline would prohibit acknowledging anything. But I felt sick with the notion of the phone call I might have to make to Gurney Tuttle. Near dinner, I went next door to see Michael. He was sitting in the dark in an old easy chair. He wore only blue jeans. His long feet and sinewy chest were bare. As June had suggested, he was shattered. "You okay?" He lifted a hand to the light. His eyes were red, swimming in sorrow. His head was crushed back in the chair, matted against his own goldish dreadlocks.
"What a horrible day," he said.
It occurred to me that he must have been sitting in that spot for hours. I'd always understood that Michael viewed himself as a neutralist. He cared for Niall. He adored physics. I had no doubt he was in love with June. In all of this, he belonged to a higher, more ephemeral realm, one where a simple purity of feeling was acceptable. Now he'd been injected, against his will, into the rough-hewn world of politics. I felt, of course, enormous kinship for him, as another soul mauled by love.
"You want to talk about it?" I asked.
He shook his head no. Throughout the day, I had pondered how much June was admitting when she told me Michael felt betrayed. I had been sure just a moment before that she was telling me Edgar and she were blameless. But as I turned over June's spare remarks, trying to collect their logic, I'd seen that, as usual, there'd been more said than I'd recognized. Near midnight, she'd left Edgar's meeting to be with Michael. That had to have been by design, by prearrangement, and as a result, he was out of the labs, otherwise occupied at the moment of impact. Neither I nor he could presume that was accidental. Standing in his bare apartment, I gave him what comfort I could.
"Look, I mean, thinking about it,"
I lowered my voice.
"She protected you, man," I said. "She did protect you."
He planted the heel of his palm squarely in the middle of his face and began to cry again. The physicist who had been injured was named Patrick Langlois, a Quebecer. He had lost almost all of his right hand. His thumb remained, some ghoulish vestige attached to a fragment of his arm. Even the dry descriptions on the news had been sickening. Michael must have known him well. From Lucy's remarks, I took it that Michael spoke to June of love, commitment, life together. Yet in imagining their relations, I doubted June was interested in any of that. She was merely seeking some fugitive reprieve in a region of pure feeling, of silence, beyond the territory of doctrine. And a part of Michael must have accepted those terms, even welcomed them. That was his truest dwelling place, anyhow. But now he was left to wonder about motivations. What idle comments of his had been passed back through 100 Flowers to the slick commandos who brought their plastique and detonators in the dark? What if he hadn't gotten June's message? What if he decided to work late, enjoying, as he often did, the hours when he had the vast laboratory to himself? He had to wonder about Edgar as well. Was he accomplishing revolution or some blow against his wife's lover? Nonetheless, I could guess what the worst part was for him. That June knew and had bowed to Edgar's will. In the most telling, the most graphic way, she had demonstrated to everyone her ultimate loyalties. Whatever hopes June had raised in Michael, she could not have more clearly chosen Edgar over him. She had spoken advisedly. He felt betrayed.
"Dinner, or you want to skip it?"
"Skip it,"
he answered.
"Look, I'm next door if you just want to hang out, man."
As it happened, June asked if I'd mind Niall while Edgar and she took a ride. That meant they would talk in the safety of their car, circling the streets for hours, checking the rear view and hatching plans. Niall and I played War and Crazy Eights most of the night.
Where'd the pigs take Edgar?
Niall asked. To the station. We went over it again and again.
But they don't erect children, do they?
Absolutely not. Nobody can arrest a child. And Edgar's fine. Isn't he fine?
He's mad. 'Cause the judge said he could go. When I'm grown up, I'm going to be a police.
You are?
Then I can erect the right people.
Look, Edgar's okay. He's fine, right? Doesn't he seem fine?
I wouldn't erect Edgar!
Niall was instantly overcome with tears. The mere thought of Edgar often seemed to upset Niall. There was never a spanking. Edgar seldom yelled. But as a father, he could not keep from being himself, always preaching, teaching, always correcting Niall, moving on to the next lesson as soon as the last one was acknowledged. At Christmas, I had witnessed an awful scene when Edgar had attempted to convince Niall to donate one of his few toys, a stuffed pig, to a poor people's collective in East Oakland. The pig was soiled and pilled, not recognizable as much more than an oblong lump the color of your gums, and Niall seldom looked at it now that he had Babu, his handsome stuffed bear, with its pelt of shiny synthetic fur. But when Edgar explained his plans for the pig, Niall held fast to it, wailing, while Edgar, in his tireless, intent way, held on too, reasoning implacably with his son about other children who had no toys at all.
I want it! Niall replied. I want it!
Niall hauled on the pig and lay back. Finally, with a small pop and a scatter in the sunlight of some dusty filament, the pig suffered the amputation of a leg. Edgar considered this at length. Eventually, he handed the bigger piece to Niall, then went to the boy's room and removed Babu. Edgar held the bear far overhead, well out of reach, as he headed to the door.
This is what the poor children are getting now, Edgar announced, his long forehead knotted by a fury that I had seldom witnessed, even when he was inciting on campus.
Niall hadn't dared to get back to his feet. He made no sound at all until his father was gone out the door, at which point the boy wailed unbearably. Decimated herself, June fell to her knees and held him in her arms, pietà-like, the two of them crippled by grief. Now, with his sudden tears about Edgar, Niall crawled into my arms. He was usually inconsolable, likely to throw tantrums and shirk a comforting hand. Instead, he accepted my embrace and clung. He would not climb down and fell off to sleep. For reasons beyond explaining, it touched me terribly that amid all my troubles, fears for my future, guilt about Hobie, my heartbreak over Sonny, Niall had found this moment to finally regard me with trust. In the dark, I curled myself about the small body, holding his fingers, rough with grime, while I absorbed the fullness of my desire to protect him and the whispered promise of a young life. Women came and went in my dreams, vague figures with whom I became enmeshed and whose yearnings I somehow could not tell from my own. I was in the midst of some vivid tableau in which one of us was being desperately pursued, but I could not tell who was following whom. I opened my eyes, and June Edgar sat on my bed. Her hand was on my chest, softly circling, prodding.
Are you awake? She whispered. Seth?
I knew this was not the first time she had said my name. I sat up. I slept nude and gathered the sheet, aware suddenly of the stiffness below of a urinary erection. Even when I wakened, June remained comfortably beside me. I asked where Niall was.
Upstairs. I took him up hours ago. I've just been lying awake, pondering something. I have to talk to you, Seth. I want you to hear me out.
She hiked herself up on the bed and came just a smidgen closer. She wore a cotton night shift, and the loose weight of her breasts trembled when she moved.
We need money, she said. Real money.
I reached beside the bedside for the lamp, careful to hold the sheet, and conscious that I'd probably exposed my backside anyway. June sat, unblinking, her hair loose as it had been the day I saw her at Michael's. Her tongue briefly touched her lips while she waited for me to shield my eyes and let the pain of the dilation pass. Somehow, it struck me that all the years she, any child, spent looking in a mirror, wondering what she would look like as an adult, at her prime. That was how June looked now. Her pretty face had the substance of maturity, the weight of intelligence and purpose. I looked at her as a human being who, unlike me, had finished the journey to whatever it was she was to become. I had no doubt she shared that judgment.
"This money is important," she said. "Very important. We have to get Cleveland out. Soon."
"Is this the bomb?"
"Seth,"
she said severely. It was the same tone that escaped her against her will now and again when she was scolding Niall. She took a moment to counsel with herself.
"There are rumors. You understand, this may all be counterintelligence by the Damon pigs. Everything I'm saying may be, so please bear that in mind. But we've heard rumors that Cleveland is talking, that he started giving them little things, hoping to get his bond reduced. I don't believe it, but with Eldridge in Algeria, there have been a lot of rifts within the Panthers, a lot of internal commotion, and we think it's possible. We've sent his mother to see him, and a lawyer. He's going to have plenty of folks at visitors' hours all weekend. But it's best for all concerned to get him out as soon as possible, certainly by next week. We have to bail him and get him out of their hands before he's blabbing his fool head off. Do you hear me?"
"Okay."
"There are many people who have an enormous amount at stake. Not only our people, all right? There are many people. People who haven't really... one of your good friends."
My heart constricted again into a tiny knot at the thought of Hopi.
"Seth, there's no use explaining. No point and no good use of it. But things will work out. I'm sure they will work out, if we can get this money."
I asked how much.
"Thousands. 10,000 minimum. 15 would be better."
She measured my astonishment.
"Now listen."
She sat forward and smoothed her hand again across my chest to subdue me. The confident way she touched me lit, not wholly to my liking, the spark of some unruly thrill.
"Now hear me out. I've been thinking, and it's a question, I suppose. It's two birds with one stone. I wondered if you could possibly reconsider this plan, this idea we discussed."
She waited until I was the first to speak the word.
"Kidnapping?"
She nodded only once, as if there was a caution against speech.
"Jesus," I said. "It seems to make so much sense from your side."
"I know, but..." The thought of scamming my father, from which I naturally recoiled, also seemed, in some moods, to imbue me momentarily with a wild lightheartedness. There was no doubt he deserved as much. Nonetheless, I shook my head.
"I can't torture them, especially not my mother." "I think we can work out what concerns you. I truly do. If you felt satisfied that could be avoided..." "I know how odd this is,"
she said.
"But it seems clear you're going to have to do something drastic. You only have a couple of days."
The 4th of May, when I was scheduled for induction, was Monday.
"If they knew you were safe, Seth, your well-being was assured. But they had to leave you be, let you go. That would be the best for you now, wouldn't it? Am I right about that?"
I didn't answer, fearful of what I was getting myself into.
"Will you think about this, please? But there isn't a lot of time."
"I understand. I have to get my head around this one." We looked at each other.
"I mean,"
I said,
"you guys, I mean, Edgar and you,"
I swallowed,
"and Niall, I mean, you're all in trouble now, right?"
real trouble.
Seth,
she stopped.
If Cleveland...
She stopped again.
Right,
she said.
Real trouble.
She looked into my eyes with purpose. I noticed only now that she had gripped me by both shoulders. There were many young men in June Edgar's life. I knew that then. She might as well have said it. I had no idea what difference it made. Nothing was going to happen between us. But some bond was forged nonetheless, if only because a fragment of me was briefly waked to the reality that other women besides Sunny existed. June padded out, barefoot, her shift clinging to her as she departed, having made a moment when, improbably, desire seemed to be the only real thing in the world.
December 8th, 1995. Sunny. Friday morning, before we start, I detain the lawyers to talk about our schedule. The prosecution case will probably take another couple of days. We concluded yesterday with Malto doing a tiresome redirect of Lavinia, reading her snippets of her statements which she claimed not to remember. Following that, Rudy examined Maybelle Downey, an older woman who had witnessed June's shooting from a tenement across from the projects, and who confirmed the same outward events Lavinia described. Now Tommy gives me the order of his remaining witnesses. Al Kratzis, the community service officer who told Niall his mother had been murdered, will be first today. After him, Hardcore. By Monday, we'll reach Edgar. Following him, the people will rest. The PA's strategy, apparently, is to buttress Hardcore's credibility by showing that his account coincides with that of witnesses, white people, whose version is largely beyond doubt. The defense case, if there is to be one, will start by Wednesday. I'm informing Hobie, who receives the news impassively. And what are your plans, Mr. Tuttle, in terms of time? Not committing the defendant to offer evidence, of course, just protecting for my benefit. 2 days. So, we'll argue at the end of next week, perhaps, or the following Monday. The three lawyers before the podium all nod. I will have to decide soon after, a disturbing prospect. The case remains murky. Why did this murder happen? I think suddenly. Frowning, I wave the lawyers away from the bench. Molto repeats the same gesture to Singh, who goes off to summon the next witness. Aloysius Kratzis, a corpulent, white-haired, thick-necked police veteran, fiddles a bit as he sits on the stand. Kratzis has the mark of a guy who went to community relations willingly, one of those coppers who started out to be a hero and ended up as a bureaucrat. No one gets shot in community relations. No one works graveyard. You dispense bad news, you visit schools, you read press releases over the phone, you front for the force at funerals and ribbon cuttings. It's either a dead end or a comfortable retirement, depending on how you view things. Al Kratzis seems to like it just fine. Rudy goes through Kratzis's rank and background and eventually reaches the morning of September 7. He had just come on, Kratzis says, 8 a.m., when he received a call. On his desk, you can envision the coffee and pastry in the white bag from the donut shop. I spoke with Detective Lieutenant Montague. And Sergeant, was Lieutenant Montague making any orders or requests of you? Montague said he was at a crime scene. White female, approximate age 60 to 65, dead of multiple gunshot wounds. She was found outside a vehicle which was registered to her ex-husband. Montague was going with another dick to talk with the husband. In the meantime, there's a health insurance card in her purse. Shows that Niall Edgar is next of kin. Somebody says he's a PO. Montague expects press will get this in a beat or two, and he wants me to get over pronto to this Niall, so we tell him before he turns on the radio or TV and hears it that way. The entire answer is hearsay. Hobie has stroked his beard throughout, waiting for anything objectionable, and has apparently decided to let it pass. And did you oblige the lieutenant? Rudy asks, in his funny, high-blown way. Rudy had 3 years of English public school before landing here. His father was one of those Indians with advanced degrees, never able to put them to use in any country. The family, Marietta says, has a liquor store on the East Bank. He give me the address, and along with Officer Vic Addison, I proceeded there. It was here in the city. The city means DuSable. Al Kratzis is one of those neighborhood guys, like my Uncle Moosh, who remember when this was still three little burgs, not, as the world now sees it, a single megalopolis. In those days, there were still intense rivalries among the Tri-Cities. At 80, Moosh still discusses the fierce games that were once played in the bitter weather of late December between the public high school football champs from Kewaunee, Moreland, and DuSable, and a single representative from the Catholic Leagues. Tommy is waving at his colleague. Rudy bends so Molto can whisper his suggestion. "Yes," says Rudy out loud. "And in asking you to take on this assignment, sir, did Montague give any indication at the time that Niall Edgar was a suspect?" Hobie objects, but he pursued the issue of when and why Montague began to regard Niall as a suspect. I overrule. "We're service, you know," says Kratzis. "In CR, we're not on the case. Our job is the public. If somebody's a suspect, Montague would assign one of his people." "Did you in fact see Niall Edgar?" "We did. Addison and I went to his apartment." Kratzis sighs, minorly disgusted with the state of his memory later in life, and checks his pocket for the report, then fishes a stout finger there again to locate his readers. 2343 Duhaney. "And what time was it?" "It was after 8 a.m., closer to 8:30. I was afraid at that hour we might have missed him, but he was there. We had to pound a while, but he come to the door. I identified my office. Somewhere in there we had to ask him to turn down the music, actually. Then I asked, was he a relation to June Edgar? He says he's the son, and I told him I was very sad." Kratzis's hand does two forward flips. "Etc., he means. "And I give him the news. All what Montague told me, just that one liner, you know, that she'd been shot dead down at Grace Street."
"And did he have any reaction that you were able to observe?"
"Pretty doggone strange," says Kratzis.
"Oh, object,"
Hobie loudly declares and shimmies his entire upper body in disapproval. I strike the answer and direct Kratzis to tell the court precisely what the defendant said and did. He takes in my instruction slowly. There are plenty of police officers, bureaucrats, departmental politicos who get through 30 years on the force with barely half a dozen court appearances. Kratzis seems like one of them.
"He give us a look. First off, it's a look, kind of, you know, wait a minute. Not so much he doesn't believe it, as it doesn't make sense."
"Your Honor," says Hobie. "Mr. Tuttle, I'm going to accord the testimony the weight I feel it deserves." Kratzis has turned himself around in the witness chair to face me, too stiff and bulky to do so with ease, but eager to address me almost conversationally. His powder blue coat bunches up thickly and the unbarbered fuzz of hairs on the back of his neck shows up, the filaments refracting the courtroom lights. He goes on explaining to me, notwithstanding the objection.
"I do this a lot, Judge. All kinds of circumstances. Little old ladies dying in bed, suicides, car wrecks. And people respond different. I'm the first to tell you that. But this was strange."
"Sergeant," I say, "just stick with the outward behavior, what he said, what he did. How did he appear?"
"You know, Judge, it's the glazed look. His mouth is hanging open. Then he's gonna talk, then he doesn't. Finally, he takes himself and sits down on his sofa and says, 'My father was supposed to be going over there.' Like he's explaining something. And that's it. For maybe 10 seconds, then suddenly he starts into cry."
Rudy takes over again. "Did you have further conversation, Sergeant, after he declared my father was supposed to go over there?" Good prosecutorial question, driving home the critical line of testimony.
"We did. We told him where the remains would be and how they could be claimed. We give him a card with the PP's number,
the police pathologists.
He was pretty shook up by then, so we left.
And following the interview, what did you do?
Back to the hall. I left a message in voicemail for Montague. I needed to speak with him ASAP.
And in your ordinary practice, would you be wanting to speak to the investigating detective?
Object, says Hobie again, tiredly. He doesn't bother to rise. The body language suggests another silly excess by the PAs. Hobie's objections have been well-timed and usually on point, so that by now I've developed a reflex that he's correct. But I recognize this time he's trying to gull me.
No, I'll hear this.
Generally, we have no need. You know, maybe I'll leave a message, we done like you asked. I'll send up a 5-sheet.
A police report named long ago in the days when there were 5 layers, with carbons.
But, you know, most times they got no need to hear from us.
So what, if anything, motivated your call to the lieutenant?
Judge, implores Hobie.
I'll sustain now. But the point is made.
Old plow horse or not, Kratzis thought the kid was wrong. He was taking something off him and knew Montague ought to get a detective out to see Niall, find out what the hell he meant that his father was supposed to have been there.
Rudy sits. I nod to Hobie for his cross.
Just a few questions, he begins. It's more than that, but he accomplishes little. Kratzis admits he's seen lots of strange reactions when he's imparted news of a loved one's death, and Hobie combats the implication of Rudy's question about the time of the visit, which suggested that Niall was late for work and might have been waiting at home for a call, by pointing out that loud music was on, which would have made it hard to hear the phone.
And you say that you're not sent out to speak with suspects, right?
Not generally.
And who is it Montague is going to talk to?
The father, says Kratzis.
Catching the drift, he adds,
'cause it was his car. You figure he'd know what she was doing down there.
Okay, says Hobie, unwilling to press the point.
A few questions later, he terminates the cross. Significantly, he does not dispute the accuracy of Kratzis' memory. That means Kratzis wrote a report that day, and that his partner, Addison, will back him up. Kratzis, with his bulk, heads out the doors of the courtroom, but stops at the prosecution table to shake hands. He did a good job. Aside from the fingerprints on the money, this is the best piece of evidence the state has offered yet. One statement, one line. Yet it has a clear impact. Niall expected Edgar to be there. Niall expressed surprise, not that there had been a shooting, but only who its victim was. The first questions anyone, no matter how shocked, normally would ask are, who shot her? Why? How could this have happened? I have my eyes closed, letting the proof work its way down through the emotional latticework. My reaction creates a lingering moment of gravity that grips the entire courtroom. When I look up, both prosecutors are watching me tensely. I call the lunch recess then, but don't get out the door. By the time I've conferred briefly with Marietta about the 2 o'clock call, Molto is in front of the bench. Hobie, typically, has found a way to disrupt Molto's calm. Tommy is livid, red up to his hairline. Hobie has presented Tommy with defense exhibits, Niall's 1994 tax return, his 1995 wage records, his bank books, his checking account statements. Molto waves all these documents about and finally lays them before me.
Judge, we should have received these documents before trial.
What's the point of them? I ask.
I don't care what the point is, really. He's not supposed to be producing exhibits now. And he won't say what the point is. We've asked him 6 times.
Mr. Tuttle?
Really, Your Honor,
he says with a sweet little smile. Are you declining to say?
No, I'll say I'd have thought it would be obvious to these prosecutors, but I guess not. The point, Your Honor, is that there is not a cash withdrawal exceeding $300 in all of 1995. Which is not surprising, since my client's savings never were greater than $3,200.
Niall didn't have the money to pay Hardcore. Not $10,000 cash. That's the point.
Tommy explodes again. Sandbagging, he calls it, which is exactly what it is. Tommy goes on at high volume, ignoring Singh's efforts to soothe him. "Mr. Tuttle," I say, "I can't see how you could have failed to think about these records before."
"Your Honor, what about them?" he points. "Really, Judge Klonsky? Here they are, planning to put a witness on the stand to claim my client paid him $10,000 in cash, and they haven't bothered asking themselves where the money came from. It's not a secret my client files tax returns or has a bank account. They should have thought of this, too. And the defense discovery response notified them we might put in these records."
Hobie hands up a boilerplate filing the state defenders use in every case, but he's got a point. Bank records and tax records are mentioned as possible defense exhibits, along with 40 or 50 other categories of documentary evidence, everything from the pathologist's studies to ballistics reports. Multo, scattershot, never pressed for details, and Hobie waited in the weeds. The lawyering life, I think. "All right, Mr. Tuttle. I want you to do a better job getting things to the state. Go through this discovery response, and before the weekend, produce any exhibits you might use. This is the last surprise, do you hear me? Given the state's lack of diligence in demanding production, I'm not going to exclude. But I won't be so generous next time." At my ruling, Tommy groans out loud. Singh attempts to drag off Malto, who, in spite of his soft, unathletic shape, has struck a bantam pose in the well of the courtroom, facing Hobie like he's spoiling for a fight. Tommy is still too furious to see that he's been outflanked again by Hobie. The good trial lawyer always wants the state's best evidence quickly forgotten. Instead of mulling over Kratzis's direct, I'm now heading off to lunch, asking myself where Niall could have gotten the money he supposedly gave Hardcore. Did he borrow it? Steal it? Hobie's right. Malto should have thought of this. Then again, Niall's fingerprints are on the money. That will be Tommy's answer in the end. It happened. The devil finds a way. It happened. As the courtroom comes back to life, I remain a minute on the bench, assessing all of this. Then find, as I gather my things, I'm facing the jury box again. Seth, once more, is waiting for me to take note of him there. By now, there is a rhythm to this. As if he knows, I'll only have time to acknowledge him at the end of the session. Yesterday afternoon, I was somewhat alarmed to find him gone. I didn't know if it was the sweaty mess he'd made of his sport coat, or, as I suspected, the heavy load of what we'd been discussing which kept him from returning. I was unsettled myself. To lose a child. The thought came hurtling at me all night. We never remember that even a century ago, this shroud, this burden, was commonplace. Talk about improving our quality of life. But Seth looks all right now. He greets me with a chipper little smile and then a wink. Like all his gestures this week, it's slightly forward but too well meant to do any real harm. "Hello," he's saying. "I'm here now. I'm okay. We're friends." And to my mild amazement, I find, before I've had time to think better of it, I've winked back. Ordell Trent. Small, sallow, mussed as the weekend approaches, Tommy Malto bleats the name when I tell the prosecution to call its next witness as we settle in after lunch.
"Ordell Trent," Annie repeats.
The name rolls on twice more, the transport deputy at the door shouting to a colleague in the rear, the second one yelling into the cage for Ordell to bring himself to the door. The keys jangle. Through the wall, we hear the solid rumble of the lockup door sliding back, and the second deputy loudly warning one of the leftovers from the just-concluded bond call to stand away. Then, after a lingering moment, Hardcore steps into the courtroom. He has been here before, when he entered a guilty plea in late September. But I knew less about him then. Now, like a lion emerging from a cave, Ordell briefly blinks away the harsh fluorescence and serenely takes in a room full of persons somewhat terrified by what they've heard about him. Behold, the killer. Mr. Trent. I point him to the witness stand. His hands are cuffed, and one of the deputies approaches to release him. Then Hardcore, somewhat stout, hugely muscled across the chest, slopes toward me, with sufficient assurance to make it a mildly uncomfortable moment. Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Sure do.
He drops his hand and settles in the witness chair. Tommy is at the podium. His brief preparatory cough resounds through the courtroom, over which a deliberative stillness has fallen. Even Niall, in a blue blazer today, appears sufficiently focused to be taken as tense. Hardcore states his name and present residence in the KCJ, Kendall County Jail. Are you known by any other name?
Gangsta tag, he rolls out the word. Hardcore.
Why don't you spell it for the reporter? Tommy suggests.
Oh, now, says Hardcore. Get spelled any number of ways. HARDKORPS. That's the one I seen.
On the walls. He probably never has cause to write it himself. An odd thought. This name, this word, does not have a parallel existence in the world of letters. It's like some sub-subatomic particle that exists only in physicists' calculations. Gang life is out there somewhere, an intense physical reality with no tie to a more refined realm of symbols. On the stand, Hardcore looks determinedly relaxed, slumping a bit. In the gallery amid the faces, I'm sure there are many T4 rollers come to see Core. As a result, he will not allow himself to appear awed. The truth of gang life is that many are primarily hangers-on, gawkers, lookouts, the adoring masses through whom the true thugs promote their name. In other words, as it often is with kids, one bad actor and 10 who think he's cool. Hardcore is well rehearsed and far more cooperative than Bug. Tommy leads him along carefully. The prosecutor's strategy is apparent. As with Lavinia, they have made, quite literally, no effort to dress up Hardcore. He sits here in the sheriff's department's blue coveralls, an ever-present reminder of his guilty plea and his acknowledged complicity in the crime. Like Bug, Core's clearly been told to be himself. He talks the same language he speaks outside. Tommy wants me to remember at all moments that this is the murdering hoodlum whom Niall Edgar took up with as a friend. Consistent with this plan, the first thing Tommy brings out is Core's lengthy juvenile record and his 2 earlier felony convictions as an adult, both for distribution of narcotics. His initial penitentiary sentence, at the age of 19, was for 3 years. His second, for possession of 14 ounces of cocaine recovered from a car he was driving, was 10 years, no parole. He got out 4 years ago. Like Lavinia, Hardcore has made an impressive deal in exchange for his testimony. 20 years for conspiracy to murder, which will amount to 10 years inside. The criminal justice system recognizes the same rule as accountants. First in, first out. The flipper has to be rewarded. Now, prior to your present incarceration, Mr. Trent, what was your profession?
Gangster, he answers.
Were you a member of any criminal organization?
BSD, he says. B for me. A familiar slogan. Hardcore amuses himself. The sandy scratchings of a goatee frame his mouth, and his large teeth have a yellowish cast when he smiles. What was your position in BSD? Top rank.
Were you one of the leaders of the gang, one of the shot callers?
Suppose so. Who is above you?
Jay, T-Rock, Cannell.
Tommy identifies them by name. And how, sir, did you make a living prior to your incarceration?
Slanging.
Slanging?
Slanging dope.
Hanging, banging, and slanging is the motto of gang life. In that street, doggerel slang, which originally meant to talk the talk, now is the term for selling drugs. A telling change. What kind of dope did you slang?
Mostly crack, some wire.
Wire is another name for speed. Anything else?
Oh, yeah, says Hardcore mildly.
Core, who has yet to be sentenced and not eager to make himself look any worse, is sluggish with his responses. But Tommy persists and forces him to admit he also sold PCP, methadone, rock cocaine, heroin, and some stolen prescription drugs. He had an organization, he says, of at least 10 people working for him, which included Lavinia. And do you know Niall Edgar? His face broadened with surly amusement. Core's thick eyes find the defendant. Hobie nudges his client, and Niall, with one hand on the chair arm, as if he needs a boost, rises for the formal courtroom identification. Core continues smiling after pointing him out. Niall takes his seat, face averted, cowed and shaken, while Hardcore continues to smile. How did you come to know the defendant?
He my P.O.
Your probation officer?
He keeping his eye on me for the court.
Parole has been abolished in this state in most instances. Instead, narcotics offenses and certain other crimes carry a period of supervised release. How long has he been your P.O.?
Seemed like a year, nearly. Had me couple others.
And how often did you see Niall?
Oh, you know, up the top, once a month.
And where did you see him?
T4.
And what was the reason for his visit?
You know, man, kinda checked me out.
Eventually, did you begin to see him more often?
Yeah, how it come down. Man got to be P.O. for a whole damn bunch of T4s.
He was assigned to be P.O. to other members of the T4 roller set of the Black Saints' disciples?
Right, says Core.
Do you know how that came about?
Seemed like he think he'd be kind of slamming, kicking it with us.
I sustain Hobie's objection to the witness testifying about the defendant's state of mind. Tommy tries it again. Did he tell you he'd asked for the assignment? Hardcore actually appears to ponder.
Yeah, man, 'cause how it were, I remember him coming out one day.
When? Asks Tommy.
Say like December. And you know I'm like, damn, Bo, you getting in my shit, seeing you more than bad weather. And he's saying, like, lot them POs don't want to get with it at the IV tower. Get they asses shot and shit. And he, like, he don't mind none. You know, so he going, gimme they all, they down by me.
That's what he said? That he told other officers he'd accept the files because he didn't mind coming to the IV tower?
Uh-huh.
You know, he got Winky, Crouch, Warbone, Handman, Turkey Swoop. Together, Tommy and Hardcore try, with only limited success, to bring out the names of the remaining members whom Niall supervised.
Dang, says Core. What that cuz be named?
Tommy lets it go. Closer to me than he has been before, Hardcore, I note, is no child. He looks to be in his mid-30s, but all youth is gone from him. His face is closed down and tough. The black, wide, roomy eyes slow-moving, his look always insolent. What the guards privately, and out of no small measure of fear, call jailhouse trash. When he lifts a hand to scratch his cheek, I see that his nails have grown long, and that each is capped by an amber section, perhaps 3/4 of an inch, adding the insinuation of a strange, random element in his character.
And once he assumed this role, how often was Niall at the tower?
Most days, seemed like.
And what was the nature of your relationship?
We ain't getting tight or nothing, but I be knowing the dude, he cool and all. Like to be hanging most of the time.
What do you mean by hanging?
You know, man, down by them doorways, hanging with the homies, hearing the hoot, laughing, you know, just hanging and all.
Did he require you to fill out monthly probation reports? Hardcore smiles and lets a hand blow by. Not so he remembers. And over time, did you ever meet any members of his family?
Uh-huh,
says Cor. Who was that?
Met his daddy.
Senator Loyal Edgar?
Loyal, huh? That his name?
Hardcore draws in his cheeks. White folks. And how did that meeting take place?
Well, see now, that's a tale.
In the witness chair, Cor laughs and rearranges himself, crossing a leg to tell his story.
Seemed like one day, you know, man, we by them benches by the tower, and I'm rapping to Niall because, you know, got to be cool with the P.O., right? And we get with it. I'd be like, yo, that D.O.C., man.
Department of Corrections.
They damn ornery with our cuz, Cannell, man. They stepped on his release twice, man. And he done his time, man. That's just bitch-ass cold. They just stepping on him because they know he tip-top BSD, because he down for his. Ain't counting no tickets or nothing he done in there. Can't be, because ain't nobody gonna say shit about him, even if he done it. You hear what I'm saying? And so Niall, he like, you all ought to best be talking with my daddy, you and you Holmes. And I like, who all your daddy? Oh, man, nigga, my daddy, he be it. He got power, Jack. He a senator and shit. He done got me my job.
Tommy interrupts. Niall told you that? That the senator had gotten him his job? With this nugget, Tommy slides his eyes at the reporters in the jury box.
Yeah, he gone on all about his daddy. Say, man, he on some committee or shit. Them DOC, they gotta listen up on him. He get on them, it be all over. Y'all oughta meet him, no lie. Maybe dude can help you out some. He be going like that.
And did you agree to meet the senator?
You know, not up the top. But Niall, man, he be, you know, you say persistent. Got to be a thing, you know. You all want to get with my daddy and all want to get with you. So one time, man, I'm kicking with T-Rock, and we fall to this thing, how my P.O. sky up about we ought to get with his daddy, help out Cuz Cannell. And T-Rock, he like, might be fat, could be fat, we kicking some serious shit here. So I say to Niall, yo, okay, we get it on with your daddy.
And did you finally meet Senator Edgar?
Sure enough.
When?
May. Seemed like about then, cause it getting to be warm, you know.
And where did this meeting take place? Gazing downward, Hardcore laughs, again his mind full of the scene.
See now, man, we done a lot fussing about that, cause T-Rock, you know, he ain't tight with too many white folks. And you know, Niall was buzzing me how his daddy's so busy and shit. So we got it finally, we gonna meet in T-Rock's SEL.
You met in Jeff T-Rock's Mercedes, is that correct? Tommy again briefly faces the press gallery. Like the customs dogs who smell drugs through steel casings, the reporters are on alert now. Here it comes. Scandal. A politician in the backseat of a limousine with street gang leaders. One of those memorable courthouse stories, people in odd places doing things no one could imagine. Through his fussy courtroom manner, Multo is unable to contain a discordant element, distaste for Edgar. The senator may be the state's witness, but the prosecutor holds him and his antics in low regard.
And where was the car located when you met?
North End, man. Can't remember quite exactly. Some corner.
And how long did the meeting last?
Say about half hour or so.
And who was present?
Now, me, T-Rock, and the daddy.
Senator Edgar.
Yeah, him,
answers Cor with a brief scowl. He does not like Edgar either. And can you tell us what was said? Cor hoots, scoffing somewhat at the memory.
Man, we was thinking we gonna get Cannell out, and this dude, the daddy, he all like whacked or something. He like, you know, got his own program, man. We going, yo, we got to do this thing here, get Cannell flying. And he like, oh, me, no, we best be organizing this shit and all. I mean, it was powerful the way he went on.
Was it Senator Edgar's idea that BSD would be the basis for a political organization?
That's what I'm saying here.
And how did you and T-Rock react?
T-Rock? After some ticks, this motherfucker, the daddy, he just up on himself, man. And T shoot me kind of a look. He like to posse out. He all ready to book. Then he come and get it. He in his own car. Kind of funny.
Cor adds and once more displays that ample smile.
Anyways, they get they self out pretty soon there, and T-Rock, he be like,